Duck, duck, goose! The Duck of Minerva in stereo.
Welcome to the Duck of Minerva podcast. In this episode, Paul Musgrave, better known to Duck of Minerva readers as PM, and I interview Phil Schroet of Pennsylvania State University. Hi, this is Dan Nexon from Georgetown University.
This is Paul Musgrave, PhD student at Georgetown University.
And this is Phil Schroet from Pennsylvania State University.
Hi, Phil. Thanks so much for agreeing to come on the podcast today.
Thank you.
So we always start these out in a very formulaic way, which is that we ask our interviewees to talk a bit about their personal and intellectual biography. So could you start us out by giving us Phil Schroet 101?
Sure. I started out as a double major in political science and mathematics. And this was back in the early 70s, and actually continued that pretty much through my whole career. I've been doing combination of political science, quantitative methods, and computer science. I actually ended up getting more seriously involved in mathematical modeling when the computer science course that I wanted to take conflicted with another course. So I ended up doing algebraic style mathematical modeling rather than computer science. So I've done programming ever since. I ended up staying at Indiana. I ended up, again, by accident, taking a course with Dina Zenas, who was one of the early leaders in quantitative international relations, and continued to work with her as a GRA through my PhD. My first position was at Northwestern, which at the time was one of the most highly quantitative programs in the country. Obviously, things have changed quite a bit since then. I stayed at Northwestern for about 11 years. I then went to Kansas, and Kansas was where I did most of the development that I'm probably best known for, which is the KEDS and later Tabari automated coding program. And at Kansas, I was doing a combination of IR and methods. And then finally, about 4 years ago, came here to Penn State, where I've got already had quite a few collaborators, a couple of former students, and so forth. And here I've been pretty much just doing methodology, and actually just at the graduate level as well. We've got plenty of IR people here. So I'm, in terms of trajectory, have gone more less in IR now, really more in methods, and specifically in the new computational methods, particularly textual analysis, but also some machine learning and things like that.
What has it been like having been on the cutting edge of these kinds of methods? I mean, a lot of people now are entering a field that is much more saturated in terms of both quantitative but also computational methodology, but you were obviously a very early adopter and early proponent of these kinds of approaches.
Yeah, it's been a mix. Certainly, it's far better than having, you know, if I were at this stage of my career and watching all the stuff that I was interested in having totally disappeared. Having said that, I think the quantitative I say mixed because, as is expressed in the Seven Deadly Sins, which we'll be talking about later, I certainly think we've made a lot of progress in terms of quantitative methods, but I think we've leveled off. We're doing the same thing over and over and over again, and that's very frustrating to watch, particularly when I see people like Chris Aiken who have been saying for years, you know, don't do it this way. That's on the purely statistical side. On the machine learning side, the computational, the big data, we're at the dawn of a new age. And you know, of course, half the hype or probably three quarters of the hype will be wrong. But things are so different now. The sort of stuff that we can do now in terms of generating real-time event data, analyzing it in sophisticated ways, just unimaginable when I started out. And that's a lot of fun. And a lot of that, of course, has been driven first by the sheer computer technology. I sort of came in at the beginning of Moore's Law, and it's still going. And then the web, for us as social scientists or political scientists, has made a huge difference. The fact that, you know, if you want to do textual analysis of what somebody says in their campaign, you go to their website. All the stuff's there. You download it. It's free. You got it, you know, in seconds. It's just unbelievable. So on that side, I'm very, very optimistic.
So I actually want to pick up on these. I mean, there's a lot of themes there. But let's go back to the mid-1970s. And one of the things that struck me as I don't think of myself as a young graduate student anymore, but certainly as somebody who's young in the profession, is your discussion of the almost surprisingly teched up nature of IR event analysis in the 1970s. And you kind of describe KEDS as being built on the foundations of this earlier work. So what came before KEDS? What were you working with Dina Zimis and others then? And why did that approach not find favor in the mid-1980s? Because my impression is that it kind of petered out around 1985 or so.
Yeah, the issue was very simple, and the issue was money. The early event data stuff, which gets going in the late 60s, early 70s, and most of that foundation we still use, was funded by some large grants. Most of my graduate career was funded by a combination of the Ford Foundation and what was called ARPA at the time, now DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And they threw a lot of money into this. And at that point, you needed a lot of money because these are human-coded events. Humans typically code between about 6 to 10 events per hour. It was all done out of newspapers, et cetera. And what happened about 1980 with the Reagan administration is all of this money dried up. Now, it partly dried up because the things they wanted to do, which are the same things we are doing now quite successfully, you couldn't do with the existing technology. Variety wasn't doing things stupid. We were just ahead of, we don't have flying cars even now. And that was kind of, we were trying to build the flying, well, we got the flying cars and event data, but we, and so the, as soon as that NSF, DARPA money dropped up, the projects were simply too big for something like NSF to continue funding. There was a little bit of funding later. And it was really only with the advent of the machine coded, which then allowed us to do these things. You know, a project, the largest the KEDS project has ever been is about 12 people. And most of the time we had, about 5 people, myself and Deborah Gerner and, a couple of grad students. Well, so a little larger, maybe half a dozen undergraduates. But these are very small projects, and yet we could produce these large-scale data sets.
So tell us a little bit more about how the machine coding worked in the 1980s. I think it's a fascinating story, especially in light of Aaron Swartz, how you got the data in the first place. But there's also a more fundamental methodological question of how this works. So to the extent it's possible, we get a very diverse methodological audience listening to this. How do you use machines to code text? And how did you do that in 1985?
Yeah, well, we didn't really do it until about 1990, if we wish to be picky here. But yeah, I'll pick up on the Aaron Swartz reference. The Aaron Swartz, for those of you who don't know, is the very, very, very skilled programmer who committed suicide about 3 weeks ago. And his crime was downloading JSTOR. And it's like, I was talking to my class about this, like, JSTOR, like you're going to stand in a street corner and say, hey, buddy, want to buy a copy of JSTOR? But anyway, leave that aside. We had exactly the opposite. The big databases, the ones that we accept, just take for granted now, LexisNexis in particular, were just beginning. I guess they'd been online, but LexisNexis actually got its start as a law reference thing. They have more money than academics. But they had this news thing on the side. And at the time, I don't know how many sources they had. It wasn't a lot, but they had Reuters. And I found out about it. We were trying to do this by hand. We had a couple of indices. It wasn't quite by hand, but it was very simple stuff. Kansas, where I was at the time, has a large debate and very successful debate program. And
I'm sorry, I'm just smiling here because my first exposure to Nexus in the late 80s, early 90s was precisely through policy debates. So just go on.
Yeah, and that was the debaters knew about it, and we had a lot of our honor students in particular were debaters, knew about this long before the faculty did, and this guy says to me, well, you know, why are you doing it this way? I think we had a CD or something with some stuff, and he said, why don't you just go over, use LexisNexis in the law school? So anyway, make a long story short, and it's written down. We've got a history of the projects on our website. But the librarian at the law school said, well, you know, you have to have a password. And he said, but let me call the LexisNexis people. So it's very fun. This is so-and-so from the law school. Our password is, repeats it, and then does it about three times. Well, you know, we can take a hint. And so that was great. He ended up downloading the Reuters. We got involved in KED, so Deborah Gerner and I, because we needed the data. We were analyzing the Middle East. We'd both done field work there. And the data sets at the time ended about, probably 78, something like that, about 20 years earlier, or 10 years. We wanted data. We wanted to get the first intifada would have just broken out, Palestinian intifada. And so it was the desire to get the data that drove us to write the program. The program's not terribly complicated. It's 14,000 lines of C, so I suppose it's complicated. The principle is simply, you know, language is a fairly regular structure. The English language, in particular, has quite a it has a very large vocabulary, but it's a very simple structure. We just basically match. We have very large dictionaries. They started out a couple of thousand phrases, verb phrases, and about 1,000 actors. They're now up to 15,000 verb phrases, and I don't know how many actors, tens of thousands. You simply, largely, it's just pattern matching. So, you know, if I know that one of the things that countries do a lot of is have meetings, we have, you know, various vocabulary to see that, you know, some country, you know, leaders of one country are visiting another one. We have lots and lots and lots of vocabulary about how people can kill each other. And just basically, we took the existing event data systems that had been developed in the 70s, particularly the Weiss system that had been developed by Charles McClellan at University of Southern California, and we simply more systematically implemented those. But, you know, in a lot of ways, it's not terribly different than what the human coding involved. Now, the humans didn't have the explicit dictionaries we do, but I ran into somebody at Cambridge, Massachusetts once who said, oh, yeah, I used to work on that project. We had this deck of cards, and we sorted them. You know, they were the training things. And I went, oh, my God, if I only had that deck of cards. But I'm sure it disappeared into a dumpster years ago. But they were coding. They were training these humans to essentially do the same type of pattern recognition that we have a computer do. We can just do it at, you know, 5,000 events per second as opposed to 10 per hour.
Well, I want to pick up on one thing that you mentioned in passing, and as you know, people have reputations, and sometimes you come across information that is surprising in light of that reputation, and your reputation is, I think it's fair to say, as a high-end methodologist, but you mentioned that you'd done field work, and, you know, the first page of your CV, you speak well enough, I presume, Arabic, as well as Norwegian. Was there ever a sense in which Phil Short could have grown up to be an ethnographer or a qualitative case researcher?
I've worked with enough of those people that do it well to know I'm an introvert. And I one of my good friends, well, my late wife, Deborah Gerner, was the field worker or the person that did the got me to the Middle East. My good friend, Leo Villalon, who's just stepped down as director of African studies at Florida. I've been with him in Senegal and watched Leo work a crowd in Wolof, not in or French. I just can't do that kind of thing. But having said that, I think the field work I've done, and it's mostly in the West Bank, and I taught Methodist at Bir Zeit University, which is a Palestinian university on the West Bank, about 20 miles from Jerusalem. That was kind of fun too. But I taught mathematical modeling in Senegal and near San Luis in the north of Senegal. So I've done both. But I think it's incredibly important to get out and see how the world works and something, and not just Europe. I mean, Europe's better than nothing. But you know, if you're going to study conflict, again, don't put yourself in danger. But at least get some idea of how people live in other areas. And that's just been both. I've lived in 5 different countries, and my Norwegian, by the way, is not very good. And my Arabic, you know, I couldn't give a university lecture, but I can go shopping. I can get around. I can get in cabs and chat with the drivers and that kind of thing. Or I could. Haven't done it for a number of years.
Well, so this is interesting. We'll come back to this later on when we talk about the 7 deadly sins, which is part of a broader conversation that you've been engaged in with a number of interlocutors, including in the qualitative and multi-method community. But for now, I want to go back and talk a little bit more about the event coding. And you're involved in a number of active research programs, and you've, of course, taken KEDS and taken it to Penn State. What's going on now? And you mentioned Twitter. What's going on now that really is much more than just being a faster way of processing the data? What can we do now in international relations that we couldn't have done 25 years ago?
Yeah, two or three things are going on. One is that machine coding gives us a lot more flexibility. And the problem with the human coded is once you code it, very, very things were recoded. It was done. Now, and that's problematic in that a lot of these, let's just take the Weiss data set, it actually survived in one form or another till about 1992, so just after the end of the Cold War. But even by the 1980s, you know, the international system was somewhat different than it was when Weiss was first developed in the late 60s or early 70s, or it was probably the early 70s. But and now, if we are what we're interested in, both theoretically and what's happening now as opposed to 1970, it's totally different. Interstate conflicts pretty much disappeared. There's rise of transnational militarized actors, just the whole long list of things. Well, we can code that now. We can adapt systems very, very quickly and keep up with it the way that we couldn't. So the big change in event data over the last 20 years has been the shift from almost exclusively a interstate thing to looking at substate actors. And as we look at the big successful application recently has been the Integrated Conflict Early Warning System, the DARPA-funded project, $40 million. Now, not all of that went to event data, but it was able to succeed in doing accurate forecasts because of the event data. And the parts of the models that drive, not the interstate parts, they're the domestic things. IQs is almost exclusively doing domestic instability events. And you go back to the 1970s, nobody was even trying to do that. The other thing that excites me tremendously is the ability to do this in real time. And the fact that we've got all of these various news providers, whether it's Reuters or BBC Monitor, or of course the Google News, which vacuums up all of these, providing stuff on the web in real time, and the machine coded data systems can code it in real time. We just got Mike Ward, Jay Ulfelder, and I just got an NSF grant where we're going to be deploying a system that will generate real time data, and you'll just be able to download it. Now, there's another system that I hope is going to be online fairly quickly. I unfortunately cannot give the details except to say it's real, and we're going to be presenting a paper at ISA, but they may even get there ahead of us. It's a system that has 200 million events already coded from 79 to the present. That's 2 or 3 orders of magnitude greater than anything else we've had in the past.
So one of the things, and I think I'll stand in for some members of our audience at least here, big data is very exciting and it teaches us a lot, but does it really help us to get to, and let me show my cards for just a second, You know, Mearsheimer and Walt have said that the problem with IR today is that we've got all this data and all this, you know, statistical wonders, but we really don't have any big theory. So what's the advantage of this increasingly precise, you know, this incredibly rich data set compared to what the field looked like in 1985, in 1990?
Yeah, I think the big advantage, I'm a skeptic on big data, even though, you know, I'm happy to have more data than less. But this notion, David had an op-ed about 2 days ago expressing skepticism, and I think for about the right reasons. I think the notion that just, and you see this in things like Wired Magazine and so forth, that you can just get the data and, you know, quote, the data will speak. Well, somebody recently said the data never speak, the data mumble. And again, we all know from, you know, research methods 101, or, you know, your theory tells you what to look for, blah, blah, blah. And I think people are mistaking domains where you don't need a theory. If I'm Walmart and I want to find out when do people stop buying, you know, aluminum Christmas trees, that's a big data problem. You know, I can do that. I can probably just do it with a database. But that's not the sort of issues we're trying to figure out. What we're trying to figure out is, you know, well, is Al-Qaeda finished or not? You know, do we need to be worried about this or not? You know, or maybe that's, well, yeah, or more to the point, to make it more theoretical, you know, is Al-Qaeda the cutting edge? Are we going to a world that looks, you know, more like Mad Max or something like that? Or is it just a flash in the pan, a black swan that occurred through a really, really odd set of circumstances, starting with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan? That's a valid question. I think data can tell us about that, but you're not going to get the question, and probably not just going to get the answer just by browsing through, you know, 200 million events. That said, I think the big advantage is that we can now test theories very easily, and because we have the data. Again, we don't always have the data we need, but particularly these general purpose event data sets, there's a lot of questions you can ask. You know, a lot of times your theory is going to come up, or your new theory, you know, like the one I just said, you know, is Al-Qaeda a flash in the pan or not? You could begin to test those very easily, and we couldn't do that. The Correlates of War project, you know, back in the 60s, Singer and France, Singer and Small and all that, that was designed to test realism. But they had to spend 10 years collecting the data before they found out that, yeah, there's 10 different versions of realism and they're all wrong. They don't hold up. And now we could do that. Again, we want to do it in, you know, an hour, but you don't have to wait 10 years. Evaluate this. And I think that ability to weed out a lot of these theories that, wow, they're really cool and they sound great in a seminar, but, you know, by the way, they don't correspond to any world that we're familiar with, that's very useful.
Can I interject here? Because you mentioned something that I think is a feature of some of these current debates, which is that there seems to be a longstanding war between self-identified realists and people who are doing large and quantitative work of the type that you're describing. So that's something that dates all the way back from what it sounds like, I mean, to the 60s. Is that right?
Yeah, and what's weird about it is that, again, if you look at the agenda of the sort of mainstream early or even up to the present, look at the Handbook of War Studies. That's all in the realist paradigm. There's nothing radically different. It's interstate. You know, it doesn't have nuances of realism, and they would come back and say, well, the realists don't have the nuances of the real world. But, you know, they're both in the same paradigm. And I think it's just a, you know, quantitative like versus qualitative types. And it's not unique to political science. You see this in some of the natural sciences, the clinicians versus the, you know, the lab guys. It's a similar type of issue.
So is the solution to this animosity just that we have a new generation of people who might be trained by realists now who are statistically literate and interested in doing work that is, you know, in math rather than in whatever the style of realism is? Or is there a kind of deeper problem which you've suggested, which is that, you know, realist theory just doesn't really have very good empirical traction?
Well, I think on realism per se, yeah, it's a theory based on that the fundamental thing going on in international politics is the interaction of unitary rational actors interacting through military power. Yeah, that happens, and it certainly was an important, as long as we're hedged, unitary part, that may well describe the first half of the 20th century, maybe even up to 1970 or so. It's not the, if you look, my big criticism of realism, this is something I'm working on another completely qualitative project with Christian Cantor on this, is that realism looks at the Thucydides and Machiavelli and their own period and said, we got a universal law, universal understanding of human history. They don't look at China, during most of its, 2,500 years of history. They don't even look at Europe. The medieval period doesn't look like realism. Roman Empire doesn't look like realism. The period, I've got a thoroughly snarky slide that says, the realist period really covers the career of Elvis Presley plus 10 years. It's people looking around them and generalizing, this is a universal law, whereas they're actually looking at a very specific thing. That goes way, way beyond the qualitative versus quantitative. But I think the ability to pick that apart quantitatively, there you can always thoroughly pick it apart qualitatively as well, is it will be useful.
What's interesting, because what you've suggested is a much more, I don't know, from an outsider's perspective, sounds like a much more radical set of propositions, right? Because if a lot of what goes on in contemporary, sort of correlative IR work is looking for nomothetic generalizations, things with sufficiently large law-like properties that they can be generalized across time and space. But the really exciting thing that we'd be doing with quantitative work is finding much more contingent regularities. How does that sort of fit together?
Yeah, and I think what I see as the the big theory stuff, that is, and sometimes this is conscious, sometimes it's unconscious, that was a product of its time, okay? Hans Morgenthau was a product of this attempt to get these universal laws of human behavior that would parallel those of Newton and so forth in the physical sciences. And that goes back to about the beginning of the 20th century. And it doesn't go much back too much further than that, interestingly, except for a small number of people. So Morgenthau and everybody else like that were simply adapting to the tenor of the times. And I think, that agenda fell apart in the natural sciences and in the philosophy of science. And I think, it's kind of, it's Wile E. Coyote, 20 yards over the cliff in the social sciences. And I think the exciting stuff is to Afghanistan doesn't look like Switzerland, except, scenically, Switzerland plus car bombs. But, but maybe Afghanistan looks like Yemen. Maybe it looks like DRC. Maybe it even looks like Mexico in the 1910s. It's not that Afghanistan is unique, but to try to, that Hamid Karzai is thinking the same way that Wilhelm II or Metternich was thinking. No, I don't think that's going to go. There was some economist, and I forget who has said, and it's not terribly profound, that keep looking for is two or three laws that explain 90% of human behavior. And what we really should be looking for is laws that explain, is 90 laws, each of which explain 2%, or the numbers don't add up. But human behavior, because these are complex open systems, is not going to have the kind of generalization that allows you to, send a space, golf cart to Mars and do it successfully, because that's pretty much a closed physical system. We're going to be dealing with stuff much more complicated.
It sounds like, in some respects, the heart of this dispute then is, if you think back to this Walden-Mearsheimer piece that got a lot of attention a few weeks ago in our circles, is what they think is a bug of quote-unquote hypothesis testing is actually a feature, right? It's seeing
the contingency of certain regularities, seeing the particularity of human social and political relations rather than looking for grand theoretical unification.
Yeah, there are probably a small number of grand theoretical laws out there, though it's hard for me to come up with. I mean, supply and demand. Price goes up, demand goes down. Well, that's fine until you get to luxury goods, and then it goes the other way. But the problem is, I think almost everything we're going to come up with is contingent. But there's a huge difference between things being contingent and no order, no definable or regular order at all. Most of the time, we spend most of our lives with a large set of cultural assumptions, and that's, by the way, is another good reason to get out of the country, is to realize that not all, suddenly, get culture shock, hitting you in the face and realize these sort of assumptions. But in a particular culture, those assumptions allow us to lead our day-to-day lives, pretty smoothly, et cetera, et cetera. And the international system in, writ large, works the same way. But that doesn't mean that a small number of grand laws is going to explain it. And I think if you look I don't think a lot of the classical realists would think the same. I think, again, it got kind of, you got these multiple things kind of caught up.
So, Phil, I want to pick up on, as we pivot now toward the seven deadly sins, your stylized account of political science, which in many respects sounds like a history of a discipline that is not international relations. If kind of the intellectual trajectory that you've been involved in has involved working on things that sound quite contemporary and quite modern in the late 60s, early 70s, using computers to analyze data, very quantitative approaches to understanding social life. You've also described the history of political science, especially American political science, as being established on essentially a notion of science that sounds more like Scientology than physics. How do these two things coexist?
I think there's two. Yeah, I've criticized, again, the American Scientology is probably a little too mean, but Christian Science, without hoping not to offend too many people's religion, but they picked up the word science for the same reason the American Political Science did, Science Association did. American Political Science Association was not doing anything that we would recognize as scientific. They were simply trying to say, we're not war dealers buying votes for, bottles of whiskey. We're a little more systematic, and they were a little more. But, the scientific stuff doesn't really kick in until about the 1930s with Charles Merriam. In terms of, and I think one of the interesting things about political science that makes it difficult to do systematically is that most of us who get involved in political science have a really good sense of politics. We're hardwired. We're social animals. We're hardwired. And I've seen a few times when I see people who just don't have a gut sense of politics trying to understand political science, and it's sad to watch. But most of us, we read, what's the crisis du jour? The new memo on killing Americans. Well, most of us, whether we're in American politics or comparative Ireland, piece together pretty much know what the issues are. Blah blah blah. We don't need numbers. And that's very different than if I'm trying to land a Mars rover. I got to have numbers. I got to understand physics. I got to, I got to do a lot of stuff there. That said, I think in this this age when so much data is available, and again, another point we do need to remember, the root of the word statistics is in fact state. Now, statistics got going as a way of characterizing enabling one to govern a state, or more to the point, extract resources for the governance of a state. So it's quantitative from the beginning. But I think what is different is we do have more data. We can, Nate Silver has the, if Nate Silver didn't have a zillion statewide polls, he wouldn't have been able to do the, the batting 1,000 he did on the most recent election, and he would be the first to agree with that. Now we do have that kind of data, and again, in IR and you know, I use IR brute. Really, international. I'm sorry, I do political conflict rather than IR per se now. But it's the same thing. We can. I'm coding this atrocities data set for Political Instability Task Force, so I can tell you where you don't want to visit. You don't want to be a Christian in Nigeria. You don't want to be a Muslim in Burma. We've got all that information now, whereas in the past we didn't.
Well, it strikes me that one of the things about your career and the careers of people who have been working to expand the field methodologically to enhance our understanding of quantitative techniques and to build data sets is that you've been constructing the kind of more homogeneous data observations that you need to conduct good investigations of theory that the Americanists with votes and voters have largely been able to assume away. It's much different to throw 200 million observations into a regression than to do what a literature I'm familiar with, the resource curse literature, does, which is to often assume that Saudi Arabia is Denmark with more oil and fewer Christians. This brings us, of course, to the seven deadly sins, and we've already touched on, by my count, about four of those sins. You gave mm-hmm. a speech. I was in the audience on a panel in Washington here at APSA. You presented the paper. It has gotten a lot of attention. Has it helped the discipline? Has it moved anybody? Has it persuaded anyone? Or do the bulk of political scientists still do more or less the same things that you and Chris Akin have been reminding us about for the past 10 or 20 years?
Clearly at the moment, they are. The way I characterize this, and this always gets a good sort of a knowing chuckle about that article, is that if you're under 35, you love the paper. If you're over 45, you hate it. And if you're between 35 and 45, you think, oh, you know, I know you're right, but this is really going to screw up my career. I think the younger, there's nothing magic about 35. Younger people read it and say, yeah, you're right, and, you know, let's do something. So when those people get to a point where they have more, I'm hoping they don't get sucked into the dark side and just keep running, you know, stars and p-values, though the dark side is very, very tempting because it's so easy. Older ones, you know, again, it's not like, you know, Akin said it, Gill said it in his own way, Gary King even said it. I didn't say anything really new. I probably said it a little more sarcastically than some people have, but you know, Chris was making this point, you know, 10 years before. I didn't made no discernible difference that I can see. I have to keep my grad students from chuckling when somebody comes in and gives a job talking to me. And when that regression, unreadable regression slide goes in, it invariably has about 12, you know, independent variables if it's an IR comparative ones. Then, you know, wiggle. But we shouldn't be running those. They're meaningless.
I have to say, I love going to panels and doing the same thing and hearing people cite a rule of three, which was Chris Akin's paper, urging us to run simpler, better thought through models. And then hearing people say, well, of course, I've read Chris Akin, and here's my model with 15 or 20, you know, linear terms, but that's okay because I only have three explanatory terms.
The computer does not know that. I know that these are the three things I'm really interested in. So certainly my good friend, the computer that I, you know, spend 8 hours a day with, is going to know that too. Well, I'm sorry, the computer doesn't know. It just sees a matrix. And, you know, what drives most conflict models? Contiguity. And I remember seeing one where the t-value is 70. And then the whole discussion was this, you know, he had a whatever the explanatory variable, I don't, it's probably a review, so I don't even know who it was, but they probably had a T of, you know, 1.97, and the entire discussion was, see, we have a significant thing, and here's this massive contiguity thing that's driving the entire model. And you see that all the time. Yeah.
Well, and I think that that's really fascinating, and, you know, to some of the Dux readers, you know, your work is perfectly positioned as one of the advocates of smarter use of models, be they linear or generalized linear or whatever, but particularly of advocating for Bayesian methods. Whereas to other readers, it's all just quant. So what is it that distinguishes the seven deadly sins from, I suppose, the eightfold path of true quantitative enlightenment?
That would probably be King Cohen and Verba, right? I guess would be the closest that we have.
You described that as being the orthodoxy.
And again, I was criticizing that before.
Before it became cool. So before it became cool.
Well, I think it was. What's interesting, okay, the King Cohen and Verba has become the Bible in a sense, and all it is just straightforward frequentist stuff that again was being criticized. Certainly, it was criticized long before it came out, but you know, it's accessible, it's easy, it makes people feel good that there's not this big quantitative qualitative divide. And I agree completely with that. What I think is going to happen is, you know, to the extent that the Society for Political Methodology is the leading edge, and we certainly should be, and I think generally are, almost everybody there now accepts, you know, that certainly we need to be much, much more Bayesian than we are. Now, the problem is Bayesian up to this point has had this kind of mystical criticism attached to it, but it's also technically quite difficult. But that's beginning to change. They're beginning to find stuff. And I'm a real fan of Bayesian model averaging. It's become the standard thing we use in the Political Instability Task Force. It's reliable. It gets rid of this whole, you know, what do you do with the 60 possible control variables, et cetera. I think people like Andrew Gelman are doing a really fantastic job in sorting out what are the real issues on Bayesian versus frequentism as opposed to some of these things that are left over from debates literally in the 1920s and so forth. I think, you know, it's classic philosophy of science. It's just going to take a generation to change. It's not people that love significance tests are going to be doing significance tests until the day they retire.
I'm having one of those moments where I'm thinking, okay, so I'm already getting lost. If I'm getting lost, then a good chunk of our listenership is probably completely befuddled. So maybe we could slow things down, wrap things back a little bit. I don't know what the metaphor we want to use. And maybe you could lay out in a little bit more detail what the core arguments of the Seven Deadly Sins article are.
The original is about 86 pages. So I guess the three things that I focus on is first and this partly comes out of my own experience, the fact that you really, models need to predict. I mean, that's the gold standard. Every place else in the sciences, we've gotten away from. And, you know, why is Nate Silver on the front page? Because Nate Silver predicts. And I think Americans have less of this problem with IR. But there's this very, very, very important article by Mike Ward and a couple of co-authors that points out that even models that we accept as very important don't predict well at all. And the reason they don't predict, going to the next point, is this obsession with significance tests. And all a significance test tells you is that the value of the coefficient is not zero. It doesn't say it's important. It doesn't distinguish, you know, explanatory versus everything else. In some contexts, that's meaningful. If I'm trying to figure out who's going to win an election, zero is a meaningful point. But if I want to determine, does GDP affect, you know, the politics in a country, the likelihood that it doesn't is pretty darn close to zero. In other words, we already know GDP development, however you want to measure it, is important. So the significance test is not telling us anything that we don't already know. And so most of this time that we're running around happy that we can put 3 stars, you know, at the on a regression table, is not, you know, Our theory told us that variable was probably important. That's why it's in the model. And the model tells us, yes, it is. And then the third major point, again, there are obviously seven in there, but is linear regression has a lot of problems. And basically every place that linear regression might fail you, it does. And there's reasons we use it, or the reasons we use it, you know, until 20 years ago, it's better than nothing, but it's sensitive to highly sensitive to outliers, sensitive to collinearity, where variables are related to each other. And most of the time in social science models, the variables are. It does absolutely crazy things in that thing. And I've got a list about, you know, 10 different things that regression does badly. And there's some newer methods, the so-called robust methods, they're mostly machine learning, that get around these. We've got a lot of ways that we could be analyzing data now that we couldn't earlier. And a lot of this is beginning to come out of the big data stuff. And again, we're going to make a lot of mistakes. You know, they're human. But I think as we gradually begin to use methods other than linear regression. Let me say the one other thing. Yeah, so why is Bayes so important? Okay, and again, there's a lot of mumbo-jumbo around Bayes theorem, but all the Bayesian model says is I start out with an idea of how the world works. I get some new data. I adjust how I think the world works on the basis of the new data. That's it. That is all that the Bayesian method is about, and that's how we think. And compare that to the interpretation of a significance test. In a significance test, you got to, you know, believe five impossible things before breakfast to even begin. And most people interpret them incorrectly anyway. Bayesian's very straightforward.
So I'm listening to this, and of course, at this moment, I'm teaching a undergraduate research methods class in political science, and some days I feel very virtuous because I'm teaching people a la Chris Akin to look at their data, to make sure they understand their data, to think hard about their data, and I have a couple of lectures that are very close to being cribbed from Morgan and Winship from Andrew Gelman, and yet at the end of the day I still have to teach them t-tests and OLS, and if I'm doing that in undergraduate, I know that most programs are still doing that in graduate education. And at some points, there does seem to be a disconnect between where the Society for Political Methodology is, where the reviewers at elite journals are, and where your average reviewer or your average practicing political scientist is. So how long is that Kuhnian demographic shift going to be?
I wish I knew. I think it's happening. It's, you know, typically I think you are, one does literally look at a, you know, human generation of, you know, roughly 20 years. And where we are in that stage, I don't know. I don't think we're at zero, but we're certainly not at 15. One of the questions we used in our methods prelim, this most recent one was design. It was just a short essay question, but, you know, if you are going to teach the three here methods as a three-semester sequence, if you're going to teach this as a Bayesian, from a Bayesian perspective, which with the significance testing is the exception, what would it look like? And I got a couple of neat little answers, but that's not, you know, what we do. That's not what we do here in State. The technical difficulties of running and specifying Bayesian models at the moment are still an impediment. But for example, Gelman is coming out with some new software, but we don't have a Bayesian King, Cohen, and Verba. We've got books by Gill and Jackman and so forth that are at a high level. And what you need is a Bayesian King, Cohen, and Verba. And by the way, about three quarters of that book, or at least two thirds, would look the same, identical. You know. Conceptualization, measurement, even to a certain extent, hypotheses. You'd probably replace a lot of the hypotheses with probability distribution. But we're not throwing out all of the quantitative methods. We're just throwing out testing for something that, whether something is zero when you know for darn sure it's not equal to zero. And again, frequentism has its place. If you're doing sampling a public opinion survey or, you know, testing, you know, a group against a control, frequentism is fine. Nothing wrong with that. It's throwing it into these things where it's not a sample. It's the entire population. And I just happen to have some new information on that population I didn't have. Bayesian, you got to do all these, you know, mind games to get that to fit into a frequentist significance type thing. Whereas with Bayesian, it's fine. It's what we do every day.
So as I think we're coming up on not quite the end of our time, but the final lap here, I had one question that is a little bit different from what we've been talking about for the past 50 minutes. And that is, your voice is so distinctive. And I don't mean your voice here on this podcast. I mean that you can tell a Phil Schroedt article by about the second sentence. And in particular, I was thinking earlier this morning, didn't he write something about dinosaurs and barbecue sauce? And then I remembered that was actually the title of your response in ISQ. How is it that you have preserved such a unique voice in writing in political science journals, which are not renowned for their creativity, except perhaps in statistical tables?
That's what I love about blogs. I can probably get away with it because I've got enough technical credibility that they can't say I'm just some clown. It may run in the family. I've got two nephews who are both doing improvisational theater now, and I did street theater when I was college. I don't know. I sometimes ask myself. These things will come out of nowhere. And then, like all good comedians, I steal. You know. So there's the thing I posted yesterday about the job market. I talk about, you know, full professors who, you know, amuse themselves by throwing kittens into wood chippers. Well, you know, that was the comment I think Dave Barry made about Dick Cheney, or somebody made about Dick Cheney. So you know, when in doubt, you steal.
I think Paul has at least one or two more questions that are sort of on the traditional political science wing, but you've opened this up. So you've recently started a blog, and as I think I commented on it, you have a fairly good voice for the blogging, so to speak. You're good at the rant and the snark, which is such a core part of what we do. Why did you decide to take up blogging?
I had been kind of watching this for a while and a little intimidated. I mean, you know, Dan Dresner in particular, just because he does it so well. And it was as much as anything, Jay Ulfelder, and seeing how Jay could take, you know, Quant, I knew him quite well from Political Instability Task Force. And then what finally pushed over is my student, Jay Yonamini, starts blogging and people are reading it. And if you're, you know, when your graduate student starts blogging, maybe it's time to blog. And it is, I found it a very, very natural, very comfortable, you know, I found a voice, so to speak, very quickly. I might burn out on it after a while. I assume lots of people do, but so far so good. I've got three or four more, that I know I'm going to write.
We should mention that both Jay Ulfelder's blog and Jay Yonamani's blog are fantastic. Jay Ulfelder has got a lot of very interesting examples of applied machine learning techniques up on his website right now.
We should also mention that Jay Ulfelder is a finalist for Best Individual Blog in this awards thing that we're running. And I think he's probably got a pretty good shot at coming out on top. We'll see.
So just to pick up on something that you mentioned and something that was recently in your blog, and since we also have Dan Nexon on the line with us, job talks, they are this curious social ritual, and they are a form of interrogation applied to both senior scholars who are hoping to move up or at least to move out, and also to junior scholars such as myself who are hoping to move in. So why is the job talk a good idea from your perspective?
I think that it is actually, and Dan made the same point yesterday or whenever, It is, in fact, representative of a lot of what we do as academics. And we spend an awful lot of time standing in front of people making, you know, mixing facts and, you know, a combination of facts and argument, putting things together. So, as I mentioned in my blog post, what pays the bill? We think of ourselves as researchers, but what pays the bills is teaching, for the most part, unless you've got a lot of outside grants. And I think the job talk is generally, and I've seen exceptions where it fails, a pretty good leading, you know, indicator for whether somebody can at least be reasonable in the classroom. I think it's, you know, and in liberal arts colleges, and even some regular, a couple of times I interviewed when I was much younger, I was told, oh, and you're going to teach a class. They usually didn't tell me this until I actually got there. That's a real challenge. But that sort of thing, you know, it's part of the game. What game? I realize it's deadly serious if you don't have a job, but, you know.
Well, I was wondering, I'm sorry, go on.
No, I'm finished.
Oh, okay. Well, I was wondering, one of the things that you had said in your post defending the job talk was you had talked about this ritual, particular ritual at Kansas, where, you know, those snooty East Coasters and West Coasters would come in and think they were talking to a bunch of rubes, and you would let them hang themselves by their own rhetorical BS. And that got me thinking, if you know, I don't know much about the history of our discipline and why we do what we do, for example, the job talk, but that there must be a really different character to that kind of activity in an era in which information isn't so readily available via the web about the nature of an institution and who's there and what they're up to. Because I can't imagine that anybody coming to an institution now who wasn't, sort of a candidate for the Darwin Awards would come in not know – to say Kansas while you're there and not know the quality of the work that was going on and the types of people that they were going to be dealing with. And so that got me thinking, you know, is the job talk in – or the whole way we do this, is it to some degree, whatever its merits, an artifact of a time when there just wasn't as much information and back channel communication and other ways of networking in the field, where there really was a kind of what are you about and what are we about at a much greater extent than there is now?
I'm not sure it is. And let me make two different arguments. But yeah, you do, trust me, get people who come into institutions without having done their homework. And even though now it's the web, for years, the APSA every year put out this thing. It was about the size of a phone book, literally, that for every single department, and listed, I think it was called the Guide to Graduate Education or something, but it listed every single person in the department, where they got their degree, what they did, blah, blah, blah. It, you know, cost $15 or whatever it cost. It was readily available. And you know, we do that now on a web page. But, you know, the information was available back then. I would argue the opposite. In terms of whether this is recent, you know, again, one of my hobbies is medieval, doing medieval stuff, and not Society for Creative Anachronism, real medieval.
Oh, that's really disappointing. I'm sorry, go on.
and you look at look at the origin of the university, you know, in about the 13th, 14th century. And what we would now call a job talk was how people, you know, made their reputation. You would, you know, if you're a roving scholar, and most everybody was, and of course everyone spoke Latin at the time, the scholars did, you wander into town, the university, and say, I'm going to take you on some topic, typically in theology, and you have a debate, and everybody turns out, and they comment, and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's not terribly different than the job talk. So in that sense, this just goes back to our roots, you know, 600, 700 years ago. So I think that's another reason it may not go away.
You also might – I don't know if you've read anything about the system of letters of recommendation in the Roman Empire, but elements of these go back even further. One of the things, though, when I sort of tried to provoke everybody into talking about the, you know, with my death to the job talk stuff, one of the points that I was trying to get us to think about, and I think I succeeded, is, you know, sort of to think about the ways in which our criteria of evaluation, the things we use to assess job candidates,
how they align with both sort of spoken and unspoken aspects of what we're looking for. One of the things that, I mean, I'm completely convinced, I agree entirely with you and with Dan Dresner, that a lot of what we do is in essence very similar to the job talk. You know, most of what we do, but you know, that we give presentations, whether it's in the teaching format or in a workshop format or in front of dignitaries or whatever, we spend a lot of time presenting our arguments. In fact, if you live in an intellectually vibrant university, you may be doing that in the hallway, right, and having interesting discussions about your work and about other people's work. But that's not something that we really explicitly talk about as an important element of what we're looking for in a colleague. I mean, so much emphasis for grad students now is placed on the publication, on the writing, on the sheer number of publications, on citation count, these factors that are rather quite distinctive from a good chunk of what we do. And they're incredibly important, but a good chunk of what we do in university life. And so I was just sort of interested, and I found it interesting that once people started to talk about why the job talk was justified, a whole set of criteria that we don't make explicit started to come into play.
Yeah. And I should say that I have certainly, on multiple, again, I've been doing this for a while, I've seen numerous cases where candidates that probably would have made really good colleagues and probably would have been better than the people we ended up, you know, hiring, ended up blowing the job talk one way or another. You know, in some cases, and actually in one case that literally they had the flu and didn't know it, but they did a really crappy presentation and they didn't get the job. And so I agree that that too much weight almost always, and this is true at Northwestern, Kansas, and Penn State, gets put on the job talk because it's the one opportunity everybody sees the same person. And some of these other, this arms race on publications is horrible. It's loading the journals down with stuff written by inexperienced people that, you know, typically just barely clears the bar. You're not ready to write stuff until, you know, ideally, probably 3 or 4 years after you've got the whole 6-year tenure thing also really screws this up. So I think the problem is, but wow, is the pressure there? I mean, it is quite literally the case that a really competitive candidate now for a job will have what would have gotten you tenure when I was in graduate school. And the escalation had already started by the time I got tenure. But, in the old days, 4 or 5 articles, that's tenure. It's impossible to believe now. But now, 4 or 5 articles may not even get you on the short. Well, the key thing that gets you in the short list is the match with what they're looking for. But even then, it's I think it's bad. It's producing a bunch of stuff that is only social values that locks up carbon, on paper. Now it doesn't do that.
You know, it's funny because the more people I talk to, I have a much, much smaller N of conversations, having really been only in a tenure track job for 10 years. Oh my gosh. It seems like only yesterday.
I will still only see them.
Well, that's good to know. But I get the sense that I almost have the sinking feeling, and maybe I'm going too far in saying this, that there's a kind of organized hypocrisy about a lot of our field, which is that we all know that publication pressures are crazy. We all know that this is not only having a deleterious impact upon the quality of the work being produced, but it's also having a deleterious effect on the nature of the conversation in the field, right? That people are trying to publish stuff before it's ready. People don't have enough time to read what is being produced. So a lot of stuff is just going into the, you know, I guess it would have been the carbon sink, but now into the ether. Yeah. Right. Or the electrons. And I think there's a lot. So there's a lot of sense that it's hurting us overall. The publication pressures, the fact that we emphasize so highly publications in a couple of journals, when there's a lot of recognition that there's a great deal of stochasticity at stake in whether you land that piece in the APSR versus, you know, a quote unquote B+ journal or a B journal. And yet everybody who says this, For the large number of people who say this, we seem to be really unable to act collectively to do anything about it. Or even to be explicit about this in settings where it would make a difference. You know, when somebody makes the argument in a hiring committee, well, this person has, you know, two IO articles and therefore we must look at them. I mean, do you see any way that we can start to get control over what you call the publishing arms race and some of the other related factors that we all think might not be the best thing for the intellectual health of the discipline?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. The first thing I would say is we're doing some of it to ourselves, but a lot of it's, or I don't know a lot, but some of it's also being driven externally. And when I was on kind of an administrative track for a while, and then I got off it, but got a sense of how deans think. Well, deans, you know, live off of other people's accomplishments. And some of this pressure, quite a bit of this pressure, it depends by institution, is coming from the dean. And the quickest, you know, the easiest way to evaluate a file is to count. It comes in at college level and university level promotion and tenure committees where you get, disciplines, that are perfectly fine. The work is, or well, actually they probably have the same complaints we do, but, you know, where the rate of production is higher because the individual contribution is smaller. So if you're only contributing 10% to an article, you're going to obviously have three times as many articles, you know, all things being equal. So you've got that. So there's multiple pressures, but some of it, yes, we do to our, due to ourselves. The obvious solution is to go to what I call the NSF rule. So National Science Foundation, when I first put in my NSF grants, which my earliest ones was late 70s, there was no restriction on the length of your vita. And so people would literally have, you know, 20, 30 page vita attached, and that became, and you'd get more and more and more stuff. Well, obviously NSF realized that, you know, it was an arms race again. So they cracked down. They said, you have 2 pages, you can list a maximum of 10 articles, 5 of which you say are relevant to the project and 5 of which you use to show off. And now they just changed the rule. You can do data sets and things. And that's it. You know, and, you know, tell where you got your education. Now there's a, you can talk about your teaching and your data sets and stuff like that. And that's it. 2 pages, 10 articles. And I've heard that suggested, you know, a number of places. I think that, and effectively, that's what we used to have when the assumption in political science before we went to the article format was a book. Well, academic book's going to be 200, 300 pages. That's very finite. And it's not going to be a lot less than that either. And you're basically packing your entire reputation into those, you know, 200 pages. And so, yeah, if we did 10 articles, 5 articles, whatever, that's about getting us back to that. And I think that would do the same thing at tenure. You know, I don't care. You know, put the number down. Yeah, I've published 36 articles, but give me the 5 or 10 that you think defines what you do. And if it's down to 5 or 10, you'll read them, or you'll read them as much as any article. If it's 50, you're not, or 50 is too high, but yeah. But I think that would do it. And you know, the system may eventually grind to a halt and people see that. Because again, NSF has been using this now for at least 30 years, probably 40. And we're fine. I never, you know, and particularly with the web, if for some reason I want to see something more, I just go off to the, you know, I'm reviewing a proposal, I just go off to the person's web page just like anybody else and check.
Paul, do you want the last question?
Well, I suppose that my last question is going to be, you know, pretty broad and also in a sense pretty selfish, which is, if you were Phil Schroed at the beginning of your career, what would you be doing now that you would have done in the 1970s or that you did in the 1970s and would no longer do?
The thing that I did and would still do is get as much computer programming and technology and so forth as you possibly can. And I think this whole, you know, big data is to a certain extent a fad. We're going to make a lot of mistakes, but fundamentally there's a whole bunch of information out there that we can analyze by machine. And it's not just going to be, you know, regression's not going to run away or go away, but it should run away. But there's a whole bunch of other methods out there, and they're a lot more appropriate. They're usually called either machine learning or nowadays you call them robust methods. And I would learn those. And that's what, you know, Bert Monroe, my colleague, just got this Eigert grant to do that. But it's, Eigert's tiny. It only affects about 15 people. Well, a little more than that. So that's number one. The other thing I would, again, just say, I said at the beginning, and I didn't go overseas until I was probably about 30. I'd been outside of the country, but in Mexico and Canada, but that was it. But get out. Don't just go to Europe. Europe's great, cool, there in the spring. But get to Africa. Certainly China. Man, China was the biggest eye-opener I ever had, and this was after, you know, years in the Middle East. And so we're out in the world. You can do it. It's dirt cheap now. As I tell people, well, your immune system's still intact. And that was the thing I wish I hadn't. I caught up, but I wish I'd done it earlier. I think I would have had a more mature understanding of how politics works in general. So travel, computers.
And travel with your computer. All right, well, thank you so much for coming on. I think this was really informative and enjoyable, and I hope that in some way, shape, or form, we can do it again sometime.
Great, and thank you very much for the opportunity, and appreciate it.
All right, well, this is Dan Nexon signing off.
And this is Paul Musgrave signing off.
And this is Phil Schroed in State College.
You've been listening to episode number 20 of the Duck of Minerva podcast. It was recorded on 7th February 2013.